सोच विचार के साथ मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम बैक टू सोच विचार। टुडे वी आर गोइंग टू अटैक अ सब्जेक्ट दैट्स वेरी क्लोज टू ऑल पाकिस्तानीज हार्ट्स। एवरी कॉन्फ्रेंस एवरी मीटिंग आई गो टू आई हियर दिस लर्न फ्रॉम चाइना। चाइना इज अ बेस्ट फ्रेंड। China is the miracle growth country of the late 20th century and the early 21st century. It's still continuing to break all world records. And we have this strong relationship with China, but more importantly, we also sense the need to learn from China, but we really don't learn from China. So today I've got hold of Mr. Khalid Malik. Now, Khalid Malik is a very, very interesting Pakistani because he has really understood China very well. I would say it's very interesting that some Pakistanis do know China, and Khalid is one of the leading Pakistanis who know China. He's lived in China. He is a Pakistani educated at Cambridge and Oxford. He is a Pakistani who's worked in the UN for a long period of time. He has held many important positions in the UN, and the most important one that I should mention, he was the director of the Human Development Report. So I would say he's in one sense a successor to Dr. Mahbub ul Haq. Dr. Mahbub ul Haq, as you all of you will recognize, was one of our most important economists. He probably was the only economist who coined terms like 22 families, poverty curtain, basic needs, that became popular terms. So Khalid Malik held the same position, Dr. Mahbub ul Haq, in the UN. Khalid Malik has also been a fellow at the University of Manchester. He has, more importantly, been the UNDP head in China, lived in China for a number of years, has still got interest in China, still knows the Chinese authorities very well, and therefore that gave him the opportunity to study China up close, and he's written a book called How China Grew. And Khalid's book is now doing very well, well-recognized, etc. Khalid is now working on setting up a global sustainability forum. He's the chair of that. So he's a very interesting and unusual guy, as I said. Well-read, well-learned, knows China very well. And today he's going to talk to us about China. He's going to tell us how China grew, why, and how China grew. And I think that's a story that I'm impatient to hear. So, Khalid, welcome to Soch Bichar.
Thank you, Nadeem, and thank you for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here with you on this podcast and to be in a position to talk about these issues as you highlighted.
So, Khalid, can you please tell us, we'll first discuss your story on China, and then we'll try and do some kind of inference about Pakistan from there. So to begin with, please tell us your story on China. I'm very keen to know, why did China grow? And I, if I'm not mistaken, at about over 10% for 30 years, am I right?
Well, let me start with the story. Mm-hmm. All things must start with a little story. In 2003, when I became head of the UN in China, as normally what people do, they prepare to go and learn about the country they're going to work in and serve in. Huh? And I spent some time with people at Harvard and at Columbia, and people who had been studying China, working on China for a very long time, and were among the world's leading experts there. But when I went to China and started working there, I realized that the story of China is a bit different from what others have been telling us. And in my first rounds of meetings, when I was meeting fellow ambassadors and others, and I remember still the British ambassador who said to me something rather revealing. He said, well, if you want to write a book about China, do it in the first 3 months. Why? Because the first 3 months, you still have a clear idea what you want to say. Because the longer you live in China, less clear you become. And he was someone who had been associated with China for over 30 years. And he felt that at that point he knew rather little about what is happening in China. So I started writing and lecturing, and of course I had a full-time job as being the head of the UN, and gradually that became a book. And the idea was to understand why has China grown so fast for so long. And it, as Nadeem, you mentioned, it's really a remarkable story that China grew by 9 to 10% growth rates for over 30 plus years. But the story is quite interesting as to why. Why has that happened? Especially when China did not follow any of the prescriptions which traditional the World Bank and the IMF would give to developing countries. It did not have a robust private sector at that time. It did not have prices which reflected scarcity values, all of that. And so you have a conundrum as to why did China do well despite not following traditional remedies. And I think the story actually starts from the time when the Communist Party took over China. In the late 40s, the life expectancy of Chinese was about 44 years, which is quite remarkable. So you go from that period to something which is close to almost 70 years, is basically a summary progress of China. And there were several factors which were important. One was that, which I've tried to argue in the book as well, that without Mao, Deng Xiaoping could not have succeeded. Deng Xiaoping was quite an extraordinary person, he's a short person, but they say that he was a short person who could look very far, who could see very far. So in some ways, China lived and followed the vision Deng Xiaoping set up for 50 years, which is quite remarkable for any nation, as any nation as large as China, 1.3 billion people. Huh? So by the time Deng Xiaoping started his open, more market-oriented reforms in the late 70s, life expectancy in China had gone up to mid-60s. The state sector, both at the rural areas and centrally, had become much stronger in the sense of the ability to do things. Deng Xiaoping did something quite remarkable. He, when he took over serious power, he basically realized that reform can only happen if those who are implementing the reform believe in it or support it. You cannot reform with people who don't believe in it. So he, in a matter of 3 to 4 years, which is a rather short period, he basically changed and upgraded the capacity of officials and leaders from district level all the way to the central level. So mayors of townships, something like 60-70% of that got changed. And younger people, more educated people brought in. People who had a commitment, who were willing to take risks. Mao did also did something quite remarkable. He heavily decentralized China. Of course, China has historically been quite decentralized. There's a famous phrase by one of the Ming emperors who was, there's a phrase that the emperor is far, the sky is high, and the emperor is far, meaning that we can do whatever we want at the local level. So you have a situation that you had conditions which were created that you had a more educated people by the time Deng Xiaoping's market reforms got into effect in the late 70s. You started experimenting. One thing which Deng Xiaoping said was quite profound. He said, we should never cross the stream without feeling the stones, which in Chinese parlance meant that never go for one macro policy all in one go. Mm-hmm. You experiment and test it out. So ever since he said that phrase, China has never taken one big macro position all in one go. Mm. They would pilot, they would test it, and they will learn from their mistakes and then roll it out. Mm. And I think that was one big reason why I would say they avoided some of the big errors which many other countries had gone through. Mm-hmm. The other thing which was, I think, quite profound was that, which is, I think, in stark contrast to maybe perhaps Pakistan, is that the ruling elite in China, the Communist Party in particular, was very conscious of the fact that if they did not improve the livelihoods and standards of people, that their own political longevity will be in doubt. Mm-hmm. So the interests of the ruling elite and the interests of people were aligned. So they would try, when I was in China and I would go to a province and you talk to the governor or the vice governor, they have tons of things they want to talk about, but they're all about how to improve matters. And so you had enormous capacity to, you worked first on people who implemented reform. You worked on people who were the subjects of reform, meaning people. Education standards went up. Schooling was made compulsory from the first 9 years of schooling became compulsory for everyone. Illiteracy campaigns were undertaken to reduce the illiteracy down. So by the time the late 70s, early 80s, you had a reasonably educated populace. And you had also great equality among people. So when reforms and openness took place, poverty went down dramatically, and many people benefited from it. And the fascinating thing is, by the time we go into the 1990s or 2000s, the rate of poverty reduction started going down a bit. Why? Because inequality started coming up. So that's just a quick broad brush approach. The other thing which was fascinating about China was that, you know, they really, for instance, just to give you an idea, land is state-owned. And
even today?
Even today, all land is state-owned.
I thought Deng Xiaoping...
No, he never touched that.
Okay.
Land is state-owned, but what they did was to strengthen farmers' capacities in terms of knowledge, understanding, access to capital, introducing new markets, and gave them some security of tenure in terms of leaseholder rights up to 25, even 30 years. So I'll give you a very interesting example. Wine production of wine, which wine is, I'm talking about what you see globally as wine, not the tradition kind of wine.
Right.
Was not really a market in China. There was no tradition of drinking wine in that way you see Westerners do. So what the municipality government started doing was they started giving long-term contracts to buy wine from emerging wine producers who were given incentives to do that. So the Chinese were very clear that they wanted the private sector to thrive as well. But they were also clear that private sector cannot survive unless they're given some guaranteed markets, at least for the first period. And fast forward it, that China is now one of the largest producers of wine globally, and they're beginning to compete at the lower end of the scale. These are just examples of how heterodox their style and institutions are.
But Khalid, let me intervene here. I hear three or four very important ideas from you. One is that Mao preceded Deng, and it needed a Mao to create a Deng.
Correct.
So while we credit Deng with a lot of credit for things that happened in China, but it was the backdrop of Mao that created it. So I want you to, you know, talk to me about that. What do you mean by Mao preceding Deng?
Yeah. You see, Mao introduced what they call the four modernizations, which is very much what Deng Xiaoping was also trying to do. And they realized that they had to modernize society. They had to modernize economy. You know, I firmly now believe that development is fundamentally about transformation. And it
so
comes to
this goes back to the point that Gershenkron was making way back in the, you know.
Right, so let me just complete that thought. And so basically they realize that you have to change people themselves, their attitudes, how they organize in order to modernize. And in some ways, in that context, social policy becomes as important, if not more important, than economic policy. So I will give you, take macroeconomic policy, monetary policy, for instance, as a fellow economist. If you are a governor of a central bank, you are taught to look at a couple of things, interest rates and money supply, fundamentally, in the way you manage money flows and how do you manage the economy. But the central bank in China took a very different tack. For them, job creation, full employment was the most important strategic objective. China, for a long period of time, had 8% growth rates as a target. Why? Because maybe the reason is that economic policy in China was not set by economists, but set by engineers. The ruling elites for a long time were engineers. And they basically said, okay, how many people are coming to the labor market? They did some rough calculation and said, well, we need to grow by 8% to employ people fully. So that became, and that's why they kept the interest rates low, even when inflation went up. And the way they dealt with inflation was through a lot of interesting innovative techniques, including some administrative measures. Mm-hmm. There's a famous case where pork prices went up dramatically. And pork meat is a very important thing for Chinese. And the way they dealt with that was to tell the governors of the provinces is that find a way to deal with the supply conditions. And they did. So you have a great focus on modernizing society, modernizing economy. Education plays a tremendously important role in it. Incentives play a role, but they play a role in a very very specific way. And traditional macroeconomic policies were subordinate to the larger strategic imperatives of full employment and high growth rates. High growth rates were not there for the sake of high growth rates, but for the purpose of keeping job markets secure and not having a problem of, you know, as people get more educated, the relationship between a human, a person and the state starts changing because they start expecting more from the state. And as long as jobs were sufficient, they felt they could deal with that, quote-unquote, civil unrest connotation. So, and then just to complete.
But Khalid, I mean, I want to go back to this. So what you're saying now is very interesting. It goes back to where development economics began and then kind of lost its way. If I recall right, the early masters of development economics, people like Ghashankaran and, you know, Leon Tiev and various people were arguing that structural transformation was required of these societies and that we needed to modernize these societies. And then somewhere along the way kicked in the other thing, which said, no, you can keep your cultures, you can keep the way you're living, but all you need to do is get the prices right and get the macro right, the Washington consensus type of thing, that the rest can remain the same. So long as we get the Washington consensus right, we will grow. But you're saying that in some sense now, after studying China, you don't agree with that?
Yeah, actually, my book is, I had to rethink my own sense and knowledge of economics. The book is actually, the middle part of the book is a more theoretical conversation on factor prices and production functions and things like that. Huh? And then it tries to come up with a different perspective. And, you know, I now come to the basic conclusion that this whole drift towards factor pricing, I mean, take since we are talking as economists, total factor productivity, right? Mm-hmm. Total factor productivity is really an attempt to say that we do not know what's going on in the economy. Because fundamentally, the whole idea of the production function was capped in labor, then they added technological progress, technology, all kind of other things were added, try to explain the very large gap which occurs when you only look at capped in labor. Mm-hmm. And then you suddenly had a huge amount of literature on total factor productivity as a proxy for overall productivity. Why? Because they couldn't explain what was going on. So this is the difference between what is called allocative efficiency, what are the old Liebenstein ideas, and what is called X efficiency, when you do something better on its own with the same set of factors in hand. So what we are talking about when you're talking about transformation is really changing the production function itself. So to present this thing in neoclassical terms, we're not talking about what is... You can talk about what's inside the production function, which is actually not that important. It's much more important to shift the production function itself.
Yeah.
And that's what education and attitudes and how you govern people and how you organize in what communities and the relationship between urban and rural communities becomes so critical. And the core element of that, the core element is actually education. And this is actually also very much connected to human development kind of thinking, which is something Amartya Sen and Mahbub brought out, that fundamentally what you're trying to do is to increase the capabilities of people to both do and think.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I'm reminded of the fact that Kuznets called what we today call total factor productivity a measure of our ignorance. But now we've mainstreamed it into calling it total factor productivity, so we don't call it measure of ignorance anymore. We think it's something that we can measure, whereas it's just a residual. It's not a measure at all. It's something that was left behind after our regressions or after whatever factors we took into account. But okay, so fair enough. So now you're talking
about... But let me just give you a nice phrase. I put a phrase in my book which says, it's a concept in search of a theory.
Fair point. Well put. Okay, now let's look at the second point that I get from your introduction, which you said that the Chinese did something very interesting. They created a reform cadre, right? And then they went all the way down to the districts, etc., whatever, down to the local level to create, Deng went there to create a cadre that was learned, that was capable of making the reform, that was capable of carrying through the ideas. Now, how important is that? Because what we do is, for example, both you and I have worked for donor agencies. You go to a country, we give them a reform list, and we say, do it. And they do it with the same people that they have. How important is that?
Yeah, actually, it's the fund and the bank which does that. We don't actually in the UN, but okay. That's a different issue.
Fair point.
But, you know, I think there's a very profound lesson in this, that the way to... Well, the Chinese recognize that reform is not a one-shot affair. And that reflected in the institutions' shifts that took place. They used to have a state planning commission. The State Planning Commission was then named National Development and Reform Commission. Why? Because you recognize that each stage of developing, you need new reforms. So you need something in the apex system of government, which is always pro-reform, trying to find solutions to things. And it's actually not a semantic distinction. It's an important distinction. That's one part. The second part is that what they did was the civil service arrangements. They basically introduced a very profound results-based management into the way they manage government. As myself, when I was in the UN, I was leading the results-based management effort in the UN system. And we were very hesitant to hold people accountable for outputs, meaning things you do as an agency. But we were very reluctant to have them be accountable for things which are beyond their control, meaning outcomes. Whether the industry is doing well or the sector is doing well or the country is doing well. The Chinese were not faced by these conceptual distinctions. So they basically said, well, if you are a governor or a vice governor of a province, your objective, you will be held accountable. Your future career depends whether your province does well in these areas. Initially, it was economic growth. And then later on, also the work we did as a UN with them, we added social indicators and we added environmental thing as well. You will be held accountable by what the province is doing, not what you've done. So you know what? That unleashes an incredible momentum for change. You cannot believe in the end it's about people. People make change happen. So I think that allowed for a huge amount of alignment of overall policy with certain things. Plus, they also realized that top leadership should not come from people who do work in ministries. Top leadership should come from people who are practical people like governors, vice governors, who know what works in their city and in their province as opposed to theory. So they actually promoted those people much faster than, say, a minister becoming then a vice premier and things like that. So they were very conscious of the softer aspects of public administration. But you know, public administration is actually not a very good word because it doesn't give you a sense of a developmental administration that you want to affect change rather than just administer. So there's a dialectic going on between the notion of administration, as the British have taught us, as a civil service maintaining law and order, as opposed to a service which says, no, and growth and development are the things we really want to do. So if you look at people themselves and look at the average age of average years of secondary and higher education, it went up dramatically in China. China in 30 years, both in economic growth and human development terms, has gone from being a low income, low human development country to a middle, at times high income, high human development country. But there also were challenges. You know, in the 2000 onwards, there were very large challenges. Inequality started going up quite sharply. Why? Because some part of the leaders in China started listening to what others were telling them. I'll give you an example. China, at its peak, was sending out 200,000 to 300,000 Chinese studying in the U.S. every year. But, you know, as Stiglitz and I have said publicly now, that it depends a lot what you are learning at universities, what you're taught. And the rest of your life, you're trying to unlearn what you've been taught because experience and reality intervene and you have to figure out what's going on. So many of these people came back to China and they have moved from middle to senior policy-making levels. And unfortunately, they started believing in the Kool-Aid they were taught at these universities. And the Kool-Aid was that prices, of course, mattered. We know they matter. But the way they handled, for instance, the health sector industry was terrible. It's a very unequal system. It's a for-fee-paying system. It mimics all the problems of the U.S. Health sector. High use of procedures, very expensive. Coverage is very low, you know, all those things. And we tried very hard to encourage a shift. So reform is needed at every stage of development. Growth is important, but it doesn't matter how broadly the growth rate is felt by people, whether small numbers benefit more than others. And the reality now in China is that you have Shanghai with both human development level and general well-being level comparable to, say, European countries. And you have Tibet and Guizhou, other provinces, which are, I would say, the higher end of African countries, certainly better than Pakistan. Huh? So you have there's some diversity, but the reality is that 1.3 billion people mostly have done better in the last 30 years, and that's quite remarkable.
But so what I hear, another interesting thing that comes out of what you're saying, that the Chinese approach to reform was not to carry a blueprint from a development economics textbook or from a major consultant in the West to call in a Stiglitz or a Nobel Prize winner and say, tell us, and then we'll just follow the cookbook. They had a learning by doing approach.
Right.
They regarded reform as a continuous enterprise and one where mistakes can be made, but you correct and you move on and you keep moving on. You've got a target in mind, you've got a results-based management, you've got a result in mind, and you find your people who are innovative to kind of feel their way through and make reform happen. That's very interesting, but is it realistic? Can every country do that, or is it just a Chinese...
Well, actually, if you look at other East Asian countries, mm-hmm. there are many features which are similar. Take the case of Korea, South Korea. Mm-hmm. South Korea in the 60s, as you know, had a per capita income which was less than Pakistan. Huh? And if you remember, you may have read that there were actually technical assistance missions after the Harvard Advisory Group was working in the Planning Commission in Pakistan, who went, including Pakistanis, to South Korea to give them advice. And there also was a technical assistance program which Pakistan did. Huh? They actually put money into South Korea. Now, what South Korea did is quite remarkable. The South Korean education system was remarkable, even, I would say, more remarkable than China's, is that they educated everyone. So if you're looking at the education levels of one generation, which is relatively low, the next generation is very high. So when you take an average, you actually it disguises what was actually happening. So I think they will take the case of industry. Our friend who's an economist at Cambridge, and this interesting book he wrote, Kicking the Ladder.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Arjun Chung.
Yeah, he basically highlighted the fact that capacity was created in the steel industry for many years, despite the advice of foreign advisors. And you know, there were quite a few American advisors in South Korea,
right,
who said that this doesn't make any sense. I mean, you don't have the capacity, you don't have the raw iron, you know, all those kind of things. Huh? Mm-hmm. And then now South Korea is one of the leaders in that. And this is equally true in countries like some of the Scandinavian countries. Nokia was subsidized by the state for 19 years before it became profitable and then became the one-third, one-fourth employer of all Finnish people kind of thing. Huh? So I think the issue of the state and public goods is very important. So if you look at China, and if you draw a graph, and you say, well, what worked? And you said, actually, one very simple thing worked, that the supply of public goods went up dramatically from the late, I would say, mid-70s or late-70s. You see the graph just exploding, roads and highways and airports. And, you know, they realized that farmer products have to be brought to the market. And the farmer's product can only be brought to the market if you have good roads and good transport systems. They invested heavily in that. They realized that you needed health and education, so they invested heavily in that. They realized that you needed a strong, active government, a pro-people government, and they invested in that. So you need to have many of these factors come together in order for a person's capability to really explode. There's some interesting articles by people like Jeff Sachs and others. I mean, Jeff is a friend, but we were always disagreed on that. And when you look at the many articles he wrote in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, and he's been following China for a long time, Western economists found it very puzzling as to why China has done well, especially when they didn't follow any of the examples, any of the recommendations on policy which they've been saying to our people. Huh? Mm-hmm. So on one hand, you see that China has done well. On the other hand, you see that there's heavy criticism of China's policies by most Western economists. So the only conclusion you can draw is that had they followed these guys' proposals, maybe they could have even grown faster. But going faster than 10, 11% a year, you know, it's not so easy to do and to maintain that for such a long time. And you can, of course, pick apart. Another interesting feature about China is that you look at the Financial Times and Western economists, but also Western observers, assessment of Chinese performance. Every year for the last 25 years, by the way, this is heavily documented, they have basically been saying the same thing. Why? Numbers lie. Numbers, Chinese numbers are made up. Secondly, there's a bubble in the making. The next year, the real estate bubble is going to burst. Third, the policies are all over the place and they're totally wrong. So you set that aside. My argument has been they must be doing something right if they've been growing so fast for so long and where you see measurable improvements in the lives of people. So this is where I drew the conclusion that development is fundamentally about transformation. It's far more important than macroeconomic policies just in terms of maintaining the economy. You have to grow and burst the economy. You have to be disruptors in that sense.
But Khaled, there's also a large part of our profession, and let me represent them for a minute. Many people from our profession will argue that the reason that China grew so fast was because Deng changed course and made China accept the free market enterprise, free market economy, and get the prices right and made sure that everybody took their own risks, etc. And so that a large part of the success is owed to the fact that China followed the Washington prescription very well. It is a good student. It implemented it well, and therefore it unleashed the productive potential of the Chinese economy. Would you agree with that?
Well, you know, actually, it's like you're trying to decide whether the horse comes first or the cart. Huh? Mm-hmm. Actually, as I said, Mao had already improved the conditions of people in China tremendously. Huh? Mm-hmm. When you go for life expectancy of 44 to life expectancy of 64, that's a huge change in people's well-being. Huh? When you set up strong administrative arrangements at different levels of government or different levels of communal work, you're creating knowledge and capacity in a way. So when you shift incentives, not prices actually, when you shift incentives, you could argue that prices in China have been distorted for a very long time. I mean, when you are shifting, when you're giving long-term contracts to create a new market. You see, the problem of developing countries is that the markets are actually quite thin. they are not embedded. They're not deep markets like the ones you have in developed countries. So price signals at the margin can play a big role, and maybe they are reasonably good at allocative efficiency, but they're not so true in developing countries because they do not provide you long-term signals for productive addition. And Pakistan is a very good example of that. You have active markets, but very little production addition, no? At all levels. I'm talking about whether it's services or in industry and things like that. And industrial strength has to be created. It's not a function of incentives, actually. Yeah, I mean, of course, there's a big debate whether you support single industries or single firms. We can go into all of that. But the fact remains, an active role of the state is essential. Very few countries, including the U.S., actually, there's not a single country example which you can cite which has developed simply because of private markets and private incentives. The Americans, for instance, if you look at their 19th century and 18th century, the state was heavily involved in almost everything.
Yeah. Look, I mean, okay, fair enough. But we'll discuss the role of the state. But there's another point that just comes to mind suddenly. I think I sense something very interesting in what you're saying. And I have some kind of sympathy for it, but I also sort of wonder about it. You keep going back to the structural transformation that Mao made. And yes, I think when you go back and look at, I consume Chinese history in a very crude way. Like, for example, looking at the old Chinese kung fu movies or whatever, and you see this culture of the Chinese sort of wearing a frock and with a ponytail and, you know, practicing the old kung fu or whatever, and then all of a sudden Mao comes along, and these people, through the Great Leap Forward and through the Cultural Revolution, are transformed into these, you know, wearing Mao jackets and the pajama suit, whatever, and they are suddenly educated, and they essentially, let me put it this way, the way I look at it is Mao essentially erased the past. He totally erased the past and made these people into these productive human beings, because now they don't carry the baggage of the Mughal Empire and the Qings and the Chengs and whatever, you know, all those dynasties. They don't carry all that. They are now the modern Chinese who are just there to learn and be productive. How important is that? Because whenever I look at us, for example, in Pakistan, I see 5,000 all the way from Mohenjo-daro to now, a cultural baggage that is built into me and into all our society. So, you know, we are looking at each other as Maliks, as Sheikhs, as Sayyids, as Rathors, as this or that. You know, there are 10,000 clans. Mao wiped that out. There's no such name now. Everybody is a Chinese. There's no differences between them. How important is that?
Yeah, I think the core idea really is that when a ruling elite feels that progress is in their interest, many things are possible. I think the sad reality of Pakistan is the ruling elite actually doesn't fully believe in that. And there's a reason for it. And there's a very good example when you look at East Punjab with West Punjab agriculture. If you remember at the time of independence, the northern Pakistan area, Punjab, was the granary for the whole of India. We had very good soil. We were supplying products all over India. So when partition came, several things happened. One was that most of the landlords in East Punjab were Muslims. So in some ways, it did not pose a big political problem for India to introduce significant land reforms, smaller size limits and all of that. And that led to a tremendous shift in the way agriculture was practiced and the way it became a culture. Education was emphasized because families wanted their sons in particular to be better educated in agriculture, technology, do wells with. So fast forward, where in Western Punjab, very little change was undertaken in terms of agrarian relations. That same soil, in fact, we could argue we had better soil. Productivity in Eastern Punjab is now 2.5 times that of Western Punjab. This is an incredible social experiment. So you can change any culture. You can change any society if you take the right measures. And the fact that you had in Pakistan agriculturists, landed families, conservative families, enter into politics, enter into industry, then these people made certain that their interests were protected. I mean, why is it, how can you otherwise explain that Pakistan agriculture income is not taxed? Especially when most of the, if you look at the land ownership, large landowners are still quite substantial in that. So you cannot argue that you're just helping small farmers by not doing that. Because these people became legislators and they made certain that their interests were protected. So
this is why Mao actually made sure that every member of the elite cleaned the same toilet as the other guy. I mean, he made sure that everybody was made equal in terms of accepting the ability to do menial tasks. But it was a huge price that China paid. Millions of people were killed. Now, can we really advocate that in every country? I mean, what is it that we need to do to bring about the structural transformation?
Yeah.
I think the cost can be huge.
The cost is, the cost of maintaining an existing system is also huge.
Good point.
You take the case of South Korea, you take the case of Taiwan, where these changes were done in a somewhat different way. But, you know, the fact remains that when you educate people, suppose in Pakistan today you make the first 9 years compulsory and you actually pay poor people to send their kids to school. In 10, 15 years, that will transform Pakistan. It's as simple as that. It's actually simpler than it looks. But there's a reason why this thing has not happened. And the reason is that many political parties and many ruling groups feel uncomfortable in unleashing the power of the people, as it were, because they're worried that one of their servants' child may end up trying to marry their daughter or something like that. It's as cultural as that, as deep-rooted as that. So it's not a function of just past history, and I think you have a point there. But it's a question is, how do you make the changes work? How do you modernize society?
That's right. Yeah.
And modernization is the key, actually.
No, I think that's very important, and that's where this idea that you bring up, the active role of the state, is important. But Khalid, we've got a problem. I mean, in most countries that I know, the state is captured by the elite. I mean, even in the US where you and I are living, we can see this happening in front of our eyes. The state is captured by the elite. So, yes, I accept your point of view. In Pakistan, or in many countries, I mean, I'm going to Africa, for example, soon. I see that when you talk about, when we bring out these prescriptions and give them to the people out there, they get distorted and they, you know, get distorted through the prism of elite capture. Now, how do we handle that?
Well, in the end, society is what it is, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you cannot affect societal changes like that. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, you know that there's a cost of not changing society also. Mm-hmm. It means that other countries are doing better and they're moving faster. And they are now becoming players in the world scene. So it's a choice which leaders have. Do they want to pursue short-term policies which will keep them in power, or they want to produce long-term policies which will empower and lead their nations into the future? So it is a struggle in that
the
sense.
The question is, how do domestic intellectuals or the domestic change makers change the calculus in the minds of the policymakers? The calculus that you are suggesting, which is very important, that the long-term, Keynes said we are all dead, that the long-term benefits outweigh the short-term gains to a few people, right?
Well,
and in the long-term, the few people who are gaining today can also gain more if we have, let's say, 10% growth per annum for 30 years. Everybody can become, these guys can become billionaires instead of currently being millionaires. So that is, how do we tackle that issue?
Well, you know, there's a very interesting examples in other countries. Take Mexico. Mm-hmm. I launched one of her reports with the president of Mexico. So he at that time, he was in his early 40s, young person. Most of his cabinet who we had interactions with that evening were in their early 40s, mid-40s. And it was fascinating to see their thinking, how they were approaching it. They decided in the beginning of their term to undertake what they call Pacto Mexico, mm-hmm. Pact of Mexico, as a long-term commitment to reform, which they said all key parties should buy into. So actually, it is doable to bring different parties together and say, look, let us agree on four things, three things, five things, whatever, and say, whatever government comes into power must honor that commitment, that we make education a high priority, that first 9 years of education is compulsory, that we will compensate poor families in sending their kids over, that we will start transferring lands which are under state ownership and not productive into massive land shifts to poorer farmers. I mean, things which will not cost the elites that much. So you, if you agree as the two, three main parties on these four or five points, then becomes a long-term commitment to reform. Reform, unfortunately, does not happen easily or quickly. And they're just the reality of life. But maybe that's one way of dealing with it. And, you know, despite the fact that the current Mexican government is under a lot of pressure these days, they have honored them, that Pacto Mexico. And, in fact, the telecommunications reform, which made Carlos Slim the richest person in the world, is now putting a lot of pressure on him to reduce the prices, make it more efficient, things like that. You're going to Tanzania, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Tanzania is actually a very interesting country in East Africa.
Right.
They had this long tradition of the cooperatives, which were not very successful, but that created this Ujamaa spirit, and in terms of being more even, and now that, and it's also quite educated people, as you know. Yeah. Education levels are relatively high compared to other African countries. So you have some of the key ingredients, which you have the right policy can make a big difference. Mm-hmm. But the wrong policy is the worrisome part. And the wrong policies are that you have outside interest coming in to, say, increase the interest rates, for instance, huh? Which immediately kill all industry, whatever little nascent industry you had. Huh? You have a situation of total free trade may not be the best thing. You know, we did a comprehensive analysis for the 2014 Global Human Rights Report of countries which have done well. And what came out was very interesting. Countries who do well when they open up to markets are those countries who have already invested in their people and invested in infrastructure. Those who don't do that, don't have that condition, actually get hurt by free trade. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You see, in the end, you need, trade has been a powerful, I think, instrument for accelerating growth rates and development. Huh?
Because China had already readied itself to participate in the global economy.
Exactly, exactly.
Okay. Khaled,
exactly.
I hear what you're saying, and I think it's very interesting point of view that, first of all, China structurally transformed its economy. Second of all, they prepared their state to be able to take on that leadership role through, you know, reorganizing and, you know, reinventing their state. And the third thing that they did was to adopt a continuous process of reform rather than just
do it
once
in a while. If I can add, actually the first thing they did was not to reform the economy, but to reform the people.
That's right. I said structural transformation of the society. That was the first
thing. Society, that's the first point.
That's the first
thing. That's why social policy... Yeah. It's so critical.
Fair enough. So those are the three things that you said. But I want to just explore those a little. Mm. So if we go back and look at China the way you've looked at it, structural transformation was important. The state was important, but not just any state. They reconfigured the state. The spirit of a continuous reform, not just one-time reform, not just sign a document and then move on. It was a spirit of continuous reform, continuous learning. They made mistakes. They turned back, corrected those mistakes, moved on. All very well. But if I were to sit down and argue with you, I would say that, okay, this may explain their growth from 3 to, say, 7-8%. The extra 2 or 3 that they've got, getting to above 10 for a long period of time, and what I see otherwise, the sudden powerhouse of industry that China created. And that powerhouse of industry moved from imitation to innovation in a matter of a few years, not decades as many other countries. How do you explain that? Where did that come from? Can you please?
Well, actually, right from the start, there was a very conscious commitment to creating domestic capacity. So take the car industry. When they set up car plants, there were provisions for all car manufacturers that they must do local R&D, they must technology transfer, and they were given timelines for that. So, and of course, the market became larger and larger. So in each of the sectors, China went from being a very low-end producer of basic commodities to a very high-end producer. So for instance, right now, China actually doesn't need any more these low-end labor-intensive kind of things anymore. I mean, you know, these low-end consumer goods, it's no longer that critical to its future strategies. It's very much in the middle to high-end.
They don't need to make pajamas and T-shirts anymore.
Because that's, the price of labor has gone. But, you know, there's also another dimension. When you do an iPhone assembly in China, they also have this great ability to shift. You know, global supply chains, they're very rigorous kind of systems. And if you shift styles and this thing, you have to do it very quickly. For instance, when the first iPhone came out, the screen cracked. And they had to retool that for a whole global chain within 3 to 4 weeks, which in most countries would have taken a year to do. But Chinese did that because they were able to. I've seen these mile-long factories where they could re-engineer those factories into producing different type of goods. In a matter of, it's a design issue, it's a process engineering issue, it's trying to break these things down. So they basically said, we will educate our people in all of these things. You foreign companies want to exploit our markets, but you teach us as we go along. And they also made a heavy commitment to exporting. And exporting was done, and you know, part of the success of China was also the to keep the exchange rate a bit undervalued. This is a hugely important exercise. So Pakistan, because
it's, you're saying it's been, that the exchange rate undervaluation was a deliberate policy?
Of course it was.
Very it's good. Not an happenstance?
No, it is very deliberate. But that was designed to give exporters that 3 to 5% margins that they needed to actually make profits.
I might add that in Pakistan, we've always had a policy of exchange rate overvaluation rather than
undervaluation. I know, which is a weird thing to do. So, okay. You know, they realize, by the way, this is balance of payment theory 101. Mm-hmm. I remember John Robinson at Cambridge talking to us about that. Yeah. You know, people were concerned about beggar thy neighbor's issues. Mm-hmm. But fundamentally, for developing countries, you need to keep your exchange at the margin a little undervalued. Uh-huh. Otherwise, you cannot make the export strategy work. And luckily, it occurred at a time where America was willing to move things around and have low-cost products. So we, in Pakistan, have done the other way around.
But let me ask you again. If, you know, we have these, as you said, these mile-long factories, these big enterprises, the, you know, Foxconn or whatever, these guys who make iPhones, etc. Tell me, how is it that they're not able to capture the state?
Sorry, say that again.
How is it that these big companies now, China has more billionaires now than all countries, I think. How is it that these guys are not able to capture
policy? Yeah, because the government and the party is the dominant one. The private entrepreneurs and sectors know that, by the way, close to 70% of new growth in China is private sector driven. Huh? Mm-hmm. So we can have another conversation on state-owned enterprises, but the dominant player is the state, and that they will not cede control to any of these interests.
But hang on, you're saying dominant player is the state, but growth comes from private investment, right?
Yeah, about 70% new. Yeah.
But at the same time, we know there's a large number of state enterprises. What role
do they play? Let me give you an interesting example. You'll be surprised, buttons. You know, buttons on your shirts. The Chinese have done something quite remarkable, which is that they basically decided one village near Shanghai decided to produce buttons. And they very rapidly made it the cottage industry became, the cottage town became a global supplier. So right now, that village, in a matter of 15 years, supplies 70% of the world's buttons.
Fascinating.
Can you imagine that?
Fascinating.
So this is all small-scale producers.
But how, my question is...
And that meant that if you fly to a place near Shanghai, you see farmers. Mm-hmm. There's a fascinating case study about how farmers who became educated went into these other things, like what I've been telling you, mm-hmm. into trading and others, and they became barons. So in Dubai and in the Gulf states, a large percentage of the real estate investments are from these guilds from that place in China, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. from the farmers coming together to make more money.
Fascinating, but this is what surprises me, Khaled. As you know, I was in the Planning Commission of Pakistan, and you know, whenever I used to think of these grand ideas, I just couldn't see how I could implement. If I went to a village and said, "Guys, I want you to become the button champion of this thing," and I gave them a plan, whatever the best I could think of, or hired the best brains in the world to make a plan, I know we couldn't do it. Now, what is it in China?
Yeah, but you have examples. You have Sialkot.
But Sialkot is something that's organic. It has been growing for the last whatever.
It has, but you know, there were private sector people.
Fair enough.
There was a very limited investment by the state into the industry. But exactly. Had the state invested more in machinery and others, they would have really gone up quite dramatically. Yeah. You need to have airports. You need to have roads.
Fair point. Fair point.
You need to give technical technology kind of support.
Huh? Fair enough.
You need to bring producers together into guilds. Huh? You need to set up standards, all kind of work which needs to be done, and you need to do that as clusters. But otherwise, you don't get economies of scale. Huh?
No, fair enough. That's you know, Michael Porter sort of says that and agreed. The question is really, what can we learn from China in terms of configuring our systems to be able to produce that spirit, to be able to create that kind of learning by doing, or that kind of unleashing the creativity of the people? What is it that China did that we can learn from?
Well, you know, I've been encouraging mm-hmm. the current government to mm-hmm. set up an independent commission, huh? mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. I thought that if individuals give advice, it's a bit difficult for the government to accept it easily, huh? mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. because of the variety of political and other reasons. And maybe an independent commission drawn from various sectors of society, where you come up with basically a 4-5 plan, 4-5 point plan, which is understandable to people, communicates with people, but has the seeds of serious change in it, that will start triggering things. But your guess is as good as mine. You probably have more experience on what works and what doesn't.
Let me ask you, if you were on that commission, mm-hmm. Just let's pretend, you know, as economists, we always assume a can opener. We always create thought experiments. So let's do a thought experiment. Let's say you are on that commission. What are the key things that you would suggest need to be done?
Well, what I mentioned earlier, that you really need to come to grips with education. The first 9 years has to become compulsory in a serious way. You have to allocate resources to it, even if it is partly wasted. Doesn't matter. You have to make certain the curricula is sensible curricula. And maybe these madrasas, you have to transform them to regular school. In the case of education, historically, public schooling is key. But unfortunately, in South Asia, public schooling has been devastated by a variety of reasons. And people feel very uneasy because of standards and but it's partly because public schooling and public education has never been fully funded. It's a funding issue in many ways. Pakistan doesn't give much money for education, which is quite crazy. And you have to make certain that people who are poor actually have incentive to send their kids to education. You must ally that incentive to their... Otherwise, you know, children, people produce children when they are poor, they treat them as producer goods, not as consumer goods. So you have to make that shift work. So that's the first thing I'll do on education.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The other thing is land is important, agriculture is important, and empowerment is important. There's a huge amount of land under various state-owned schemes. and which elites and particularly rich people are constantly eyeing to get contracts. I think there's a huge opportunity of a very substantial transfer of land, which is not necessarily great land, but is doable land. And one thing we have learned is that any country, depending on the right application of technology and expertise and knowledge, can make that land flourish. There have been some interesting experiments in Pakistan about how to transform degraded lands into productive lands. So I think you have to give people, and you have to break this. The rural condition is the worst condition in Pakistan. You have to break that that sense of misery and hopelessness. And these are the people who come to urban areas, and these are the people who actually are also amenable to all kind of Islamic these radical forces, which, you know, because radical forces give education and they look after people, and so there's a investment before they reap the return. So you have to create those investments as a state, as a society yourself, which competes and does better. I mean, you take the case of the Taliban. A survey was done that they found that over 70% of the young men in the Taliban were actually there for jobs and incomes. So you have to employ young people. So I don't care whether the schemes are productive or not, but they have to be employed.
Fair point.
And these are the schemes which can be introduced rather easily. They can be progressive. When I was in China and I had this interesting chat with the president at that time, Zardari, and this is the beginning of China-Pakistan relationship. So I had said to him, you know, there are a couple of things you can do to actually transform the relationship between China and Pakistan. And one very simple thing is to say, okay, we will say that 1,000+ Pakistanis will learn Chinese. And put the state resources behind it. And the very fact they learn Chinese, get into Chinese culture, they will get to know some Chinese, that will transform a relationship. That's a transformative act. So you have to think of numbers. Another idea is then you do coding on Pakistan is still quite good, although India does more of the IT kind of the IT coding and back office kind of work. If you suddenly say, okay, there's a special scheme to produce 100,000 computer literate young men, young women in Pakistan, and the state will be fully behind it. Scholarships go to universities. You know, if you, at the macro level, when you add it up, it's not that expensive. But it's very important.
Khaled, the only thing I'm surprised by, I agree with much of what you say. I didn't hear anything on the role of the state and how the state was configured by Deng in that list.
Yeah, but the state thing needs the... I would introduce resource-based management. I mean, if you shift the incentives for civil servants, the commissioners and deputy commissioners and make at the district level and the provincial level, their futures depend on it. I mean, of course, they'll be heavily resisted by civil servants because they don't want it like that. They don't want to work hard. This will transform that. But, you'll be surprised how much people do for their careers. As we all know.
But right now, in their careers, the biggest thing is the plot that they get. The biggest thing is the houses that they get. And the biggest thing is the perks of the job. You can see the civil servant, the secretaries roam around with 10 people behind them. And, you know, they have 10 cars waiting for them. Their electricity bill is paid. They live in a palatial house. They have a house in Lahore where their family can live. And, they get 2 plots for doing the right thing for the prime minister. How does that sit with such a situation?
Yeah, I don't even mind that.
Okay.
But that should be only a reward after they've shown some performance.
Okay, fair enough.
So basically, what we are saying is, if Punjab or Balochistan or Pakhtunkhwa does well on these indicators, then you get those things.
Okay.
But if you do those indicators, we start withdrawing some of these things.
So, but is it possible to tie these perks into that?
But that's what results-based management does, you know.
Okay, fair enough. Now, let me ask you another question, which is very important, which is, I think we can't close this without addressing that, otherwise people will kill us. You know, this issue of democracy versus communism, this issue that comes up all the time, that Chinese system is not democratic, therefore it's not sustainable. And this was highlighted very well in this famous book now, which almost everybody is reading, Why Nations Fail, where they made a big prediction saying that Chinese reform or Chinese growth is not sustainable over the medium term. And this century, we'll see, you know, China either transform politically or, you know, suffer a huge setback. How would you?
Yeah, you know, when I was leading the Human Development Board office, I was at Harvard. We were giving some talks there. Mm-hmm. And one of the very famous professors, I won't name him because mm-hmm. I don't want to embarrass him, mm-hmm. Who said to me that, you know, we know in 50 years what India should look like, mm-hmm. meaning more like the U.S., yeah. mm-hmm. but we don't know how China would look like. Mm-hmm. And this is why we don't think China's growth is sustainable. Huh? Mm-hmm. You know, the very fact you say something like that mm-hmm. means that you have not looked at history. Mm-hmm. And there's a great arrogance in the assumption you're making that in the end, this is a natural order of things, meaning they all have to look like Western societies. You know, China has a continuous history of 3,000 to 4,000, 5,000 years. And the Chinese have their own sense of philosophy and of what is right and what is wrong and what is good and what is bad. Huh? And how you deal with human beings and relations. So I don't buy that, to be quite honest. Huh? Mm-hmm. If you remember also some years ago, there was a whole spate of books which basically said India's growth rates, India will basically grow to become a much larger country, much larger economy than China's. Huh? Mm-hmm. But when you dig into those studies, the basic assumption is there's be a huge demographic dividend, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it does not factor into productivity levels. So if you look at China right now in terms of average productivity levels, the gap between China and India and others is increasing, not decreasing. So my own prediction is China will keep on growing for another 30, 40 years. And that's very massive. You should think about in terms of progress, in terms of physical infrastructure. I mean, it's almost unthinkable, but my own per capita income levels in China compared to the U.S. are still not comparable. So I think there's a huge prospect, which will say in my book also, I try to cover long-term growth rates. Huh? Mm-hmm. So I think this will happen. I don't think then why nations fail. I don't want to get into a discussion of that and be critical of it. I mean, I thought that was an interesting book. But basically, you know, it's being a bit too flip with the historical forces. I think in the end, if people and societies want to change, improve, they do. And leadership matters in that. So if you do not have leadership, if you're not well-educated, you can also suffer. Huh? So you know, the cardinal history is actually not sentimental. Huh?
Fair enough. The cardinal tenet of the way we learn things is that leadership is best developed, as in other things, through competitive forces. That's why we need democracy to give a ground rules to be able to get the best man to come forward or the best woman to come forward. Now, when you have got a communist party and you've got internal selection mechanisms which are not competitive, then we all feel that it would be it would create difficulties in the long run. When you say that it'll continue to grow for 40-50 years, you're assuming that the leadership will continue to be seeded in some fashion to bring out the best people in China, and most Western commentators are very skeptical of that.
Well, actually, the Chinese system is highly competitive internally. And it's almost like a pyramid. So by the time you are Deputy Director General, DG, there's a huge amount of pressure on you to perform and go to the next level. Otherwise, you retire early. There's a winnowing process which takes place. And no leader is expected to stay longer than they should. No state leader can stay longer than 10 years. I'm talking about the very top leaders. No minister can stay longer than, I think, 67 years. No vice premier can stay longer than 70 years. They're very precise on that. And the other thing which is interesting is that when you leave your office, the state will keep on looking after you, but you cannot meddle in governance.
And you can't promote your children into the jobs?
Well,
that's unthinkable for us.
Yeah, and you can't promote your children because there's a huge backlash on, we can go into some details on that. But the fact remains that in democracy, you have to find a way to cut the money from competition. If democracy means that you have a process of raising money and through money you influence elections, there's no guarantee. There's an information problem, as you know. You can apply Stiglitz's Nobel Prize finding into the same issue, that you basically are distorting the incentives. And therefore, why is it that no young leaders have come up in Pakistan?
Good question.
I mean, typically you would hear younger people talking, and even though there's a very active civil society and social media now in Pakistan, but why isn't the young leaders not coming up?
Good point.
Because fundamentally, politics in Pakistan is money-driven. And this is the curse also in the U.S. But, in the U.K. it's less so, but still there are challenges there. So today state says that there will be no more money raised and we will actually provide money for elections, anyone can compete. That will change the dynamic completely.
Fascinating. Khalid, I think this has been wonderful. It's really been instructive, and I think the points that you bring out are extremely important and we should learn from them. I think what you said about structural transformation is very critical. The more I learn about the world, the more I think that structural transformation is extremely important. You just can't change the economy and leave the rest alone. You just can't get the prices right and leave the rest alone. In fact, when I was at the Planning Commission, the framework economic growth that we made was exactly this, that we have to begin to think about transforming our society. The second point that you make is also very important, that we have to get the state right. It's not just that what the state should do, but also the capacity of the state, the ability of the state to perform. So we have to transform the state from the bottom up, as Deng did. The third point that you made also, which is very important, is that for God's sakes, we have to create a learning society. And learning is just not schooling, but learning at every level. And we have to create a society that's capable of reforming or changing itself continuously, not just once, but continuously, because we live in a globalized, high-speed world, so we have to change continuously. That means we have to create a learning society, a learning by doing society. And that is something that China has shown us. The third, fourth thing that is very important, that the state must be able to think ahead, lead society. That means a very different state from what it is. And finally, what you said is also very important. We have to also worry about our relationship with the rest of the world through our exchange rate. This nonsense about keeping our exchange rate overvalued has to be reevaluated by our leaders. We must begin to think about it, reevaluate our policies there. And finally, what you said about Chinese sustainability and the critique of why nations fail, I think that's a very valid point. When they've succeeded for 5,000 years, why should we doubt them now? And why should we think that there's only one system in the world? We have to be more eclectic, more open to change, more open to thought. Khalid, I would request you that we do a few more, because you've got some very interesting thoughts. We have to do something on HDR, for example, because I think you've got interesting things there. We have to do something on the role of the state. So I'm going to bother you a few times in the future to do a few more, because I think kids in Pakistan can learn a lot from you. Now, as I told you and I do with other people, I want to request you for one last thought. Can you recommend a book or an article or even a movie, anything that you like that kids in Pakistan can use to, question, debate, understand?
That's a very good question. one has to think about this a bit.
go ahead.
You know, there's a wonderful movie I saw some time ago. Mm-hmm. It's called 28 Days. Mm-hmm. And that's about how the Kennedys, how close the world came to a nuclear confederation, and how important good leadership was, how important it was to make up your own mind, how important it was to understand why things were happening and not to be led by what others are saying. I thought that was quite profound. But in terms of the book, let me think about it a bit.
But that's fine. 28 mm. days. 28 mm. days. Mm. It's a movie about Kennedy. Mm. And you think it's an important movie for people to understand how policy decisions are made.
Yeah, that's the 28 days during the Cuban crisis.
Okay, great, mm. wonderful. If you have a book, quickly tell us, otherwise it doesn't matter. You've made one recommendation, that's good enough.
I passed the test.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you very much, Khalid.
My great
this has
pleasure.
Been wonderful Nadeem. Talking to you.
Yeah.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai. Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.